All over Spain, as we speak, people of a certain age have just been flicking V signs, pogoing, and perhaps even gobbing out of the window. Sex Pistols and anarchy in the UK. The image of Jordan in her white shards of Beehive and Mondrian makeup is one of the most iconic in pop history. But nobody knows what was really going on behind the watchful eyes when anarchy did indeed hit the UK. How did a ballet mad girl from Sleepy Sussex make her way via the gay clubs of Brighton and London to 430 King's Road and the eye of Punk's Storm? It's part of a book. She's sharing her hair-raising adventures with McLaren and Westwoods, the Sex Pistols, Adam and the Ants, Derek Jarman, and Andy Warhol. The book is called Defying Gravity, Jordan's Story. I am delighted to be joining me live on the line from somewhere, I believe, in darkest London, perhaps. Jordan herself, good afternoon to you, Jordan.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's lovely to talk to you all.
It's so lovely to...
Yeah, I hope it's really, really beautiful and sunny over there.
Looking out of my window across, I can see the shimmering Mediterranean. How's that for a starter, anyway?
Oh, you lucky things.
You know, you had the recent good weather anyway. So, talking about good weather, summer of 76, hottest summer on record. You were at the eye of the Punk Storm. You were working at 430 King's Road. Tell us what that was all about.
Yes, I worked there for some years, right at the very beginning of the inception of the punk movement, if you want to call it that. Really, I think probably history tells us that there were probably three people that were involved in that whole beginning of giving people that freedom of thought. And one was obviously Malcolm McLaren, Vivian Westwood, and myself. We were in this wonderful place, which went through various incarnations of different styles, and but still with exactly the same sort of ethos, which is, you can be what you want to be, and don't be afraid, and, feel life is for you, and don't just get bullied and pushed around. You're your own person, and that epitomises what punk is to me. It's not a particular look, but it's a way of thinking.
I mean, when did you decide that you were going to embrace this look? And because you were, as it says in the notes, you were a ballet mad girl from Sleepy Sussex. So what happened? Why didn't you just go on to, you know, like ABBA and that sort of thing? And why did you decide you wanted to follow the punk movement?
Well, I didn't actually follow it. It was a very strange thing. I was doing the same sort of thing in Sleepy Seaford, which is a coastal town, getting into lots of trouble by the way I looked and acted. But I was doing something which was, in fact, very much on a parallel to what Vivian and Malcolm were doing up in London. And in fact, in the book, Vivian actually said she'd never seen anything like me. So I made a really big impression. But, that was making stuff out of 50s stuff, pulling it to pieces, very much DIY. And this place just caught my attention on a brief little, tiny little advert at the beginning of a magazine. And I went up there and I desperately wanted to work there because I knew it was a home from home for me, really.
And what was your first impression then when you walked into Sex the Shop and saw Malcolm, if he was there, and Vivian? What were they like as human beings?
Well, it's very, very interesting because I actually first met Michael Collins, and he was the manager at the shop at the time. And it was him who sort of interviewed me to start with. And we just carried on talking for hours. And I remember actually sitting, I had an old hospital bed at the very back of the shop. So you had to sort of run the gauntlet and get to the back of the shop. And there was one of those really old, like 1940s metal hospital beds that was covered in pink rubber. And that's what I remember, sitting on that and talking to Michael for hours. And there wasn't a job available at the time, but when it did come up, I was absolutely there. They called me up and I started to work there. And in a way, I guess, became a spokesperson for that time.
And it says in the notes, by the way, that your daily commute from Sleepy Sussex to London was it at one point you caused so much uproar you had to be moved to first class?
Absolutely true, yes. And some of these things do tend to get a bit blown out of proportion, but it's absolutely true. I did get a lot of opposition from people, especially people who had children, who thought I was debauched and, you know, causing some terrible sexual upset on the train. And it got, you know, I went up every day, and obviously the train drivers and people at the station were sort of kind of getting fed up with it. And they were really kind and said, just sit in the first class and, you know, nobody will bother you in there.
I mean, you had the thing of youth on your side. Did you ever feel worried about this? Did you ever feel threatened? I mean, because you were getting abused, and men didn't know what to make of you.
This is a very interesting question, because of course people sexually see you. I was wearing stuff that you probably would think would be a lot of men's sort of sexual fantasy, if you like. I wasn't wearing these things to court that sort of feeling. I used those myself, my body, my face, as a kind of work of art. I wanted to change myself, but I also wanted it as a sort of badge of independence, if you like, that anyone can wear anything wherever you are. And I didn't want it to be ever labelled as either as being a sexual object or being feminist, either of those things, you know, I'm not really into. What I'm into is that you should be able to wear what you like, when you like. And I saw the beauty in these creations, and especially the latex and the leather wear that I wore in the street. Again, that was usually, you know, just behind closed doors, you know, secret clubs, what have you. But I saw that as just beautiful, you know, like a sculpture, really. And that's what I wanted to do, was just be myself, you know, like most people.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you think when you're doing this in the 70s, and yet, like 10 years ago, Rihanna has an album out called S&M, or a song on an album called S&M, and nobody bats an eyelid. But this is 70s UK, very austere, and you know, you're doing this for a tremendous effect.
I think it's also to do with just how comfortable you feel. You know, but you mentioned earlier that background in dancing, it was a passion of mine, and it also makes you stand and walk in a different way, and you feel very confident about yourself. You've also put yourself through hard work to become a dancer and gone through a lot of pain. And I think, you know, it does show whether when you're wearing a costume as such, as opposed to when you're being yourself. And I think that's probably why I took a lot of limelight, because I just was comfortable, and it showed. As Adam said in the book, you know, I was wearing punk on the front line when other people were just dressing up. And there's a very big distinction, I think, to that. And he's spot on there.
There's a great picture I saw actually doing some research of you and Adam. Is it the premiere of Saturday Night Fever or something?
Yes. That
must have been quite an interesting evening, to put it mildly.
You know, that was so bizarre, because I think I was wearing that big Venus T-shirt with all the studs on it, wasn't I? And they wanted me to dance with John Travolta.
Right.
Yes, it would have made a great shot. And it was the Evening Standard came over to me, you know, and said, go on, you know, you're a dancer. You know, this is a film about dancing and with a story. You know, go and, you know, do a dance for us. Actually, he did one with Diana, didn't he, some years later? He danced with her.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, crikey, no, I can't do that. I was absolutely torn about doing it, but in the end, I actually was asked to do a review of it for the Evening Standard. And you can understand, I probably wasn't that impressed with it, really.
I mean,
but I like it better as the years have gone on.
I mean, if you think about it, these are the two big musical genres of that time in the 70s. You've got punk and you've got disco, which again was you know, Saturday Night Fever was a huge movie in the UK. You've been described as being, if you like, at the ground zero of a movement with punk, and I know it's something you had yourself, but did you actually feel that from the Shop Sex, and you had people like Adam Ant coming in, you had the Pistols coming in, you had, you know, Malcolm McLaren and Vinnie Westwood, did you feel you were part of a movement? Is this just something you were doing together as kindred spirits?
Yes, I saw ourselves, all of us there, as a kind of team, actually. You know, like a great script, you know, like a great film that's got the perfect actors in it, although we weren't acting. But, you know, that's what makes things successful, is being believable. And, you know, when you really do live something like that, you are believable. Because it's true. What you're doing is full of confidence and full of happiness, really. And I didn't necessarily think too far into the future. I didn't think, you know, this is going to be some storming thing that's going to happen. But I did think that certainly when the Pistols came along, I thought that merging of music and fashion, but important fashion, you know, nobody can doubt that was important. And I think that's a very rare thing when you get that whole thing coming together. And I felt that rush coming on. I could feel something was stirring big time there.
I mean, 76, you say, you know, we have that hot summer. But by 77, and there's a tremendous rush, by 77, when, you know, it's the Queen's Silver Jubilee, I remember it well, seat parties, and punk sort of, would you say it became mainstream? You talked about punk as being something, in your own image, very positive, but there became, if you like, the destructive, the anarchist versions of punk as well.
Firstly, I think on the positive side, and there's so much positivity about that whole time, which is that women and men merged into or blurred into one thing, really. They could share each other's clothes and makeup, and they could go out looking, you know, really brilliant. They spend hours getting ready, and it was, you know, it's a great sort of feeling of empowerment. But you also, whatever happens, you will always get an element of people that are kind of just thuggish for the sake of it. And I think probably, you know, punk, the fashion side of punk, not the mental side, because I think there's been people through all of history that have been punks. You know, every painter that's challenged the norm has been called, you know, is a punk. They're not called it because it wasn't penned. But that's what they are. They're free thinking, starting, if you like, a movement that's different. You know, the Dadaists and Cubists, all of those people that like right at the very core of a new idea, I would consider them as punk because of their mentality. I don't think really that, you know, there was an element of thuggishness that came into, you know, going up and down the King's Road. Which, you know, I'm not bothered about because I think, you know, this thing lasted because of the memory of it and it never got stale.
I mean, did you actually manage to do a lot of work at the shop itself? Or was it mainly, you know, when the Pistols took off, was it mainly going to clubs and premieres and getting in all sorts of hours in the morning?
I did all of it. I worked at the shop. I, you know, it's one of the reasons I actually left London because, you know, if my candle had three wicks, it would have been, they would have all been burning, you know. It was very, very, very hectic, mad times. And I also, you know, I'd go to the shop, work all day in the shop. I'd try, you know, get to a gig with the Ants or go to a club and then go to another club after that. Many times I'd leave a late night club, which would finish at sort of 7 in the morning, and I'd go straight to work from there.
And
then do another day's work.
I was going to say, and probably crash out in that bed at the back for maybe for a couple of minutes or something.
Yeah. Actually, one time there was a very bad incident. I fell asleep in the shop, and when I woke up, all of my jewellery was gone.
Somebody had come in and...
taking it off my hand.
Oh, blimey. So, when do you think it started? When did it all get too much? I mean, the Pistols, you know, Malcolm and the Pistols went global. You know, had God Save the Queen. And then there was, if you like, the come down, you know, this you know, what happened with Sid and what happened with Nancy. I mean, was it at that point that you decided it was time to get out and you'd had enough?
I think that tour of America that Malcolm organised for the Pistols, I mean, I had many phone calls from Sid, you know, in the middle of the night saying how unhappy he was. It was a mistake to think that you could take a band like the Sex Pistols to places that were so provincial, and not just provincial, but American provincial, and not have people who are, you know, very violent. And, you know, there's whole swathes of America that are, you know, Bible Belt, you know. It's not the place that you take the Sex Pistols. I also saw a kind of disintegration of... in the drug scene, a lot of people were dying. Friends were dying around me, really. Great friends, you know, like Johnny Saunders and Jerry Nolan, Sid, of course. It's Dee Dee Ramone, another one. You know, you just feel so like you... They couldn't get out. They couldn't get out of that whole cyclic lifestyle. And I didn't want to end up being in that sort of you know, nightmare, really. So I decided that I really needed to get out, go home.
Mm. What was the reaction like from everybody in the scene? Did they say, well, you know, you can't get out. You've been described as the original Sex Pistol by Derek Jarman, great film director. I mean, were they shocked that you left, and because you were everywhere, and then, as they say, you were gone?
Yeah, I think part of the disintegration was to do with my marriage to my ex-husband. And I had put a lot into that, to the band that he had. And he was, you know, that band could have been really wonderful, truthfully. But, you know, the whole drug lifestyle has destroyed many a band, and that was one of them. And I actually got out to save myself. And, you know, when I do something like this, I make a decision, it's absolutely cut and dried. You know, there's no going back. I think very carefully about things, but there is no going back. If I decide that that's it, I'm off. I don't care what anyone thinks. It was difficult because I went back to Seaford, which is a small town. People knew who I was, recognized me all the time. And it was difficult, but I knew that I'd kind of saved myself, really.
Mm.
Saved my mentality and my body.
And what's it like? Sorry.
Yeah, another thing is that, you know, you never know what's going to happen in this life. And my mum died, you know, 4 years after I came back. And she was 71, it's not old.
Mm.
Died very, very suddenly at home. And if, you know... If I hadn't gone back at that time, I wouldn't have spent those 4 years with her, which was, you know, wonderful in retrospect. I could, you know, if I'd been in London and that had happened, you would have felt that everything had fallen by the wayside and you hadn't had time to talk to your mum really properly, you know?
Mm. What's it like now looking at people like Johnny? And you see Mick Jones around the place as well, and they're regarded now as almost like, you know, punk royalty. And I'm thinking about the pictures from the recent, you know, from the funeral of Malcolm a couple of years back, and they're looked at as almost as national treasures. Do you think they would have thought this is what would have happened to them in 76, 77?
I doubt it very much. I don't think anybody thought. You know, that's what's so great. It was a time of spontaneity. I don't think anyone thought about, you know, beyond the next week, really.
Mm.
I am absolutely amazed at the amount of people who've told me really, really heartfelt stories about what that time meant to them, what I meant to them, and what I mean to their children as well, because that whole thing has been passed on to another generation. And I feel very, very touched, and continue to be touched by the kindness of people. And so, you know, I did a talk not long ago and it almost had me in tears, this woman, because, you know, it was absolutely Natalie from her deepest of her emotions, and how, you know, she would have been a different person but for, I guess, for me and what went on. I don't think at the time anyone really thought more than a week ahead.
Yeah, but I mean,
that's the beauty of it.
You could, I mean, you could argue the thing that is the fact that if you were, because you know, by sort of 75, 74, 75, pop and music has become this big pompous, you know, huge album thing with 80,000 tracks. And if you were a kid from Basildon or a kid from the north, you didn't have any expression, and you had to fit in that way. But if you heard 2.5 minutes of blistering punk, then you thought, yeah, I can do this. You know, I can put makeup on, I can be different, and I can fight. And that's you can trace punk's line back to everything that's happening today with kids making music in their bedrooms or on their iPhones.
You're right. I mean, there wasn't the technology to do that particularly, but there were little studios then. A lot of things were done on 8-tracks. And yes, what was astounding, I think, as well, is that it opened up that whole musical side to women.
Mm.
Because they could pick up a pair of drumsticks. They could pick up a bass and learn it, in a week. And it really empowered both men and women to blurred those lines between sexuality.
And if you
it is we've got more better technology now that enables anyone really to record anything at any time. But it was a great bit in the book, where Marco Brody from the Ants, calls somebody up to get on a train to come to 430 King's Road to listen to Jonathan Richman and Roadrunner on the jukebox. And this bloke made it to the train, got all up to the King's Road, and just to listen to that little single.
Mm. Why do you...
You can't do that now, because you could play it over the phone to them.
Yeah, but it's not the same as putting the effort in, is it? Why do you think? Why do you think the time was right then to come back and to write "Defying Gravity," your story with Kathy Unsworth, who wrote it with somebody, and what were the reactions from the people who the survivors from that original crowd? Were they happy to remember the stories?
Well, I think Kathy and I have been and still are the most amazing team. Which is one of the reasons that I actually wanted to write the book, because I found the right person to work with. It's very, very important, because we've all seen diaries of punk. I didn't want it to be like that. I wanted it to be a social comment. And I wanted other people to contribute to it. It was absolutely a must for me. And because both of us are so... I guess inquisitive, you've got to be if you write something, you've got to listen to people. And we did all of the interviews together. Every single person that's in the book contributed. We did all the interviews together. And it was more like just putting a dictaphone, like a digital recorder on the table and just listening to what they had to say. And it was very relaxed. I think that shows in the book. It was they trusted us.
Mm.
What the other catalyst was, Colin Fallows did a really, really great exhibition at the British Library in 2016. And that made it very clear to me, because I just went to the opening party and I did a thing on the Ramones as well, which was a few days later there. It just made me realise that people were genuinely still very, very interested in that whole life and my life, I guess.
Mm.
So you need a catalyst to make things happen, and those two things came together.
And is there a specific moment when you look back and you were putting it together that you thought, yeah, that's the high water mark? That was when everybody was in the same direction. This was the time when it was brilliant. This is when everything we're trying to do was coming together. Did you revisit that?
Well, there's lots of amazing memories. I'm really not into nostalgia, because I am into history.
Yeah.
We learn from history. If you wipe history out, then you have nothing to go by. And I'm not into nostalgia for nostalgia's sake. So I'm still very critical about things, and I look at things, in the clear light of day. But, I think... Probably the book itself comes from a different area of that life, that lifestyle. And I really wanted it to be something that there's a lot of musical references in it as well. Kathy is an absolutely brilliant person for that because she's written a music dress before as well. So she has a brilliant mind for that. And I think, you know, it was the right time to do this book. Who wants to do an autobiography when you're 25, you know? Mm. You haven't got your life lived by that time. And, you know, that's not necessarily a revival, but I just think that people now are almost in the same boat as they were then, with, you know, massive banding of clothes, throwaway items, things that are just really rubbish. And I think, you know, buying loads of things and sending them all back, you know, that's another thing. I always appreciated what I wore, and I used to save up hard for it. Mm. You know, my life has been full of anticipation. So one thing, you know, that's so important to me is looking forward to something. And I think maybe, you know, we've lost that a little bit, the younger generation sometimes. You know, they can buy a lot of rubbish and send most of it back. You know, I do have a problem, yeah, with sweatshops as well, and, you know, all these clothes that are just made for less than a round of drinks or less than a drink at a pub, you know. I just think beauty, I look to beauty for and design. And always have. I think maybe there's a little bit of a wilderness coming about now as well.
Perhaps we need a second revolution and some more punk, yeah, coming into our life. Do you ever hear, we spoke off air about Paul and Jenny Cook. Do you hear from others in the scene, Adam Ant, for example?
Adam is a great friend of mine and always will be. We've been through such a lot together.
Yeah.
And we really, our minds are absolutely melded together. You know, that's the reason why we've remained friends for so long. It's probably my ultimately, you know, most long-lasting friend from those days. Paul Cook. You know, he's a very shy man, you know, I was really, really pleased with him agreeing to do it. He didn't bat a eyelid about doing his part in this book. And there are lots of other people that I've actually re-established contact with through doing this process of writing the book.
That must be quite a thing as well.
It is. It certainly is. I mean, you know, I went to see Slaughter of the Dogs last night.
And how is that? I mean, you know, how have they aged? How have we all aged? Because it's called Defying Gravity. I've still got some hair left, but I mean, are we all decaying gracefully, would you say?
I think probably a lot of the bands that played then in the 70s now are even better in a way, because sound system's better, venues are better, and they're not just, a lot of them are bringing new stuff out as well, which is really great. It was an absolute blast last night. My right ear is really suffering this morning. It's really bad. Well, you know, I woke up this morning and I really couldn't hear much out of my right ear.
Marvellous.
But everybody looked great last night. You know, nobody looked like, you know, people have lost their hair a bit. Okay. Everyone, you know, looked really, really good in the audience. It was a great night.
Great to hear. And I can't let you go without talking a little bit about the fact that you are now a veterinary nurse and you've got a thing for cats.
Yes, I've worked for, 26 years as a veterinary nurse. When I came back to my hometown, I really wanted to do something that I felt could make a difference, which is, you know, caring for animals. I'd always had a cat, even through all of that time, all of the punk era. I'd had Burmese cat. In fact, Derek Dunbar and Simon Barker, who were very influential as well, part of the Bromley contingent, if you like. Mm-hmm. I got my first Burmese cat, and there's a great picture of me in Simon Barker's book, Punk's Dead. of me sitting there with my Burmese cat in on the table, giving me a kiss on the nose, and in the background is a Sex Pistols poster.
Marvellous. There you go.
My it brings it all together.
Exactly. Punk, and you can put whatever you want in there. The book is called Defying Gravity, Jordan's Story. It's Jordan with Kathy Unsworth. It's out now by the Omnibus Press. Jordan, if people want to find out more about you, is there social media? Can they find you that way?
Yes, very much so. I've got a book page, which is Jordan Mooney, Autobiography, Defying Gravity. And I'm also on Facebook as well. As myself, Jordan Mooney.
Marvellous. The book is called Defining Gravity. I'm going to run out of time. It's been a pleasure and a privilege to speak to you. I could have done this for another 4 or 5 hours. Jordan,
it's been a delight.
Thanks so much for your time today. Have a great weekend.
Yeah, you too, and love to everybody out there.